I solved a big snack problem in our household in a very simple way. My children love eating berries, and so do I, for not just the taste, but the vitamins and nutrients, fiber, all the good stuff we want on a regular basis. The problem? We all know what it's like to pick up a berry we just bought, and it's already growing fuzz in the fridge. So I've switched to buying frozen berries. And a favorite I look for now is Washington Red Raspberries. Did you know 90% of frozen red raspberries in the United States are grown in Washington State and mostly grown on family farms who harvest them during peak ripeness and clean and freeze on location, sealing in all that freshness, taste, and great nutritional value. So now I use frozen raspberries in our yogurt or smoothies as a sweet treat. And I love that this means I can support local American farmers and have a healthy snack for my family that withstands the test of time. You can find Washington Red Raspberries at your local grocery store or Costco. And how do you know you're getting the good stuff? Well, you just take a peek at the packaging and look for product of the U.S., and then you'll know you're on the right path. Oh, and if you want some fun recipes and more information, go to redraz.org. That's redraz.org. And you're going to find recipes, health tips, retail locations, everything you need to make frozen Washington red raspberries a regular part of your routine. Overall, it's just a smarter choice. Hi, everybody. We have a bit of a breaking news situation this morning, a breaking news situation that's building upon another breaking news story that just developed over last weekend. And because it's Friday, we're heading into yet another weekend. I thought it was just the right time to sit down and have a quick chat about what we're seeing in the Middle East. Just a very general overview. Last weekend, we saw a historic attack from Iran on Israel. And then over the last 12 hours, we got news of some sort of attack, or so it was described, in Iran. And all fingers have been pointing at Israel for this because there's been an anticipation of retaliation because of what happened last weekend. But we're still in a stage of gathering the facts. And so I think it's really important to know that. But because the potential and the stakes of this story are very high, I wanted to bring in someone with an expertise in the region, someone who speaks the language, which is also very important in this case, Farsi. Farsi is the language of Iran, and who not only has an academic and technical knowledge of what we're going to be discussing, but also has a cultural understanding of the dynamics at play. And there's really no one better than Ben Talablu. He's the senior fellow at the Foundation for Defensive Democracies. You may recognize him because we've talked to him in the past, but when someone's good, we want to bring them back. And it's nice to have you back, Benham, as we've been corresponding over the last couple of days about this news story. And I've been watching your work and listening to a lot of your interviews. You know, set the stage for us, if you will. You were up almost all last night. I know you look at news from all over the world. What should we know? What should we know about what just happened in Iran, or maybe what didn't happen in Iran?
Thank you, Jenna. It's always good to be back. And despite trying to normally keep crazy time zones with this job, even when there is no war in the region, Iran is about 8.5 hours ahead of East Coast time. That half hour is a very interesting part of the time difference. It's tough. But now when there's a conflict going on and you're talking to people in Europe and Asia at the same time, it gets even harder. So there's a lot of people in Washington who have not slept, I think, for the past week and a half, 2 weeks since the strike on what is alleged to be an Iranian consular annex in Damascus, but in reality seems to be more of a base for Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, located right next to or right near Iran's embassy in Damascus. That was basically the drop that overflowed the bucket in the shadow war between Israel and Iran that led Iran to go overt and conventional when it was usually covert and asymmetric against Israel in the past four decades. This is how they've adjudicated their strategic competition with one another. Iran had promised to strike back. And in the about 10, 12 days from April 1st, you had seen the Iranian government, military officials, political officials, religious officials even flood the airwaves with commentary that we had seen a la January 2020, when the U.S. killed Iran's chief terrorist in Iraq, Qasem Soleimani. There was talk about a revenge. There was talk about slapping Israel. There was talk about exacting punishment. But many had toned down these expectations because you had a lot of other Iranian officials talking about strategic patience and choosing a time and place and not playing to Israel's conventional advantage. You've even had, you know, large, you know, amounts of commentary put out by Iran's supreme leader that ultimately issued a threat, but also walked back a threat. But within 72 hours before April 13, April 14, the U.S. media really began to beat the drumbeat, saying that there is intelligence, there is evidence, there are missiles being moved. They even talked about the types of weapons, cruise missiles and drones, that Iran would be striking at Israel. And lo and behold, I think something around 4 p.m. U.S. East Coast time, the Islamic Republic began to launch barrages of drones, later on followed by land attack cruise missiles, later on followed by a historic first, ballistic missiles. These are weapons of war that fly high and fast, you know, can carry hundreds of kilos of explosive material in their warheads at the Jewish state. Fortunately, almost all of it was intercepted. I don't necessarily believe the 99% interception rate that immediately after Israeli media said and has circulated widely. I think it's a very, very high interception rate, probably 85 to 95. Not that this stuff matters, but anytime something is 99 in the Middle East, it reminds me of an election that Saddam Hussein would have, or that former Libyan president Muammar Gaddafi would have. So 99% is always just a number to be a little bit cautious of. In response to that, Israel had said if Israeli territory is struck, Iranian territory would be struck. Because after all, Israel has had the conventional military advantage over Iran for all of these years, and yet still never overtly attacked Iran. There was talk about cyber attacks in the past. There was talk about assassinations of nuclear scientists. There was talk about drone strikes on military facilities. There was sabotage of Iran's nuclear, military, and missile facilities, but never an overt kinetic attack. And the Islamic Republic changed that equation by firing these missiles. So it became a matter of when and not if Israel would respond. Two things factored into Iran's response that they were hoping for. One is that the Biden administration might politically constrain or restrain Israel from responding. After all, this is an election year. After all, Israel itself has been in war in Gaza for 6 months, the potential of which we've already seen wider regional ramifications of, with Lebanon, with Yemen, with militias in Iraq and Syria targeting the U.S., in the past few months, about 170 times from mid-October to early February. This had even led to some fatalities, particularly three U.S. service persons in Jordan were killed late in January. And what we bring to the fore now is what has reported last night about 10 p.m.-ish East Coast time, that Iranian air defense sirens and guns were being sounded in the central city of Esfahan. Esfahan is about 4.5 hours south of the capital, Tehran. It is home to tons of World Heritage sites. It used to be the old capital of Iran about half a millennia ago. But also, critically for security purposes, it's home to a very, very, very large nuclear complex, mini reactor work, but more importantly, nuclear storage facility and nuclear conversion facility. This is essential on the front end, on the back end of Iran's enrichment process. There's also a missile base on the outskirts of the town. There's also an air base, a strike base that has actually F-14s and Su-24s. So the sounds of explosions that went off likely got people to think that one of these things, the missile base, the nuclear facilities, or the air base, was struck by the Israelis. Later on, the Iranian press said that they shot down some small drones, and then they kind of wiped that away. Later on, you had International Atomic Energy Agency folks say that the nuclear facility in Esfahan was not militarily targeted, leading one to believe that it was a military facility that was being targeted, or a radar installation, for example. In my view, the weapon has not been said yet. Early reporting, in my view, misreported what the weapon was. They said an Israeli missile attack. I think based on what we can piece together through the open source, this was a low and slow flying drone attack, particularly a quadcopter attack. These are cheaper drones that you have to be in close up to be able to fire. And I think it stands in sharp contrast to what Iran had done, which was public, overt, massive, but largely a failure. And this was semi-public, semi-overt, precise, and largely successful if they're targeting one particular installation. Because after all, Israel has never overtly struck Iran. But if you're able to just spook them and then you see where some of their air defenses are, particularly around their nuclear facilities, this sends a message that we can penetrate your country from within. We can penetrate your airspace without some of your other air defenses and missile defenses going off, and even cause an explosion, and then you'll react to it only on the back end. The final thing I would say is this is Israel's way of probably trying to restore deterrence, although something may you know, not shake out well in the future, given that there still is a regional war going on and the Islamic Republic said it would retain the right to respond. But given that Iranian media this morning is showing images of calm in the city of Esfahan, this could be a bookend for the escalation cycle if the Ayatollahs want it. So that was a very long-winded way of saying it was tit for massive tat for medium tit, and then a potential to de-escalate.
Well, it was an excellent overview, and I'm glad you brought us back to the events in Syria, which I want to wrap back into in just a moment. Do you think what we've seen over the last several hours is a prologue to a larger conflict?
It certainly could be, meaning there is a historic nature to Iran's strike that, in the eyes of some, particularly even in the right in Israel, remains unanswered. So there might be domestic pressure for more military action, but there is a foreign constraint, meaning the U.S., particularly the view of the Biden administration, and particularly the view of the Biden administration in an election year. Whereas some in Israel might want more deterrence, the administration wants de-escalation and deconfliction. And it's been clear about that before October 7th. And it's been even clearer about that after October 7th.
So but I think you can want that. You can want that. But other people will want other things, or events will lead to other calculations. Do you think that desire for de-escalation, and we're moving a little into politics, but I'm curious about this. We understand that's the policy, but is that even a choice right now? Can we make that choice right now? Is there still opportunity for that?
Well, we're talking about this as if it's, you know, a dance between two people. You know, this old saying, it takes two to tango. This is the Americans and the Israelis with the politics of war. But in my view, the driver of the war, the engine of the conflict, is neither party. It's, in fact, the government of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which has been trying to orchestrate a multi-front war vis-a-vis Israel. It backed Hamas on October 7. Even the guy the Israelis killed on April 1st in Damascus, Brigadier General Zahedi, he's a Quds Force official. His regime, his resume reads as the cream of the crop, if you will, of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. But more importantly, you had Iranian outlets laud his death a few days after, saying that he helped plan that terrorist attack that killed 1,200 people. So, you know, they're, rather than hiding, they're now showing off. And they're showing off because they feel confident. And if they feel confident, you have to ask yourself why. And one strong reason has been, despite the good intentions of the Biden administration, anytime you overtly press for de-escalation and deconfliction with a weaker adversary, you might end up underwriting the next cycle of escalation. And that's been the philosophical flaw in the pulled punches on the sanctions to try to get a nuclear deal. Whereas the more money you allow them to generate, the more emboldened they become, the more the resources they have for their terrorism program, their missile program, their drone program, their nuclear program, and the less likely a diplomatic resolution or even stopgap measure becomes. So in this sense, the philosophy that animates the policy of the Biden administration in the region is understandable, but it is, in my view, critically flawed, and it doesn't look like it's changing.
I want to play a soundbite from Secretary of State Antony Blinken in just a moment so people can actually hear what the United States is saying on the record. But just for our audience, you know, what we're talking about as far as the debate of foreign policy and the right sort of stance of a nation and publicly advocating for de-escalation versus not. I mean, these are age-old debates about the right way forward that go back beyond the political parties that are currently in power. I mean, these are age-old debates about how do you keep your nation safe? So yes, it's focused on the Biden administration right now because they're in office, but we could have a very similar debate if there's a Republican in office in the future. So let me go ahead. This was very interesting in these last several hours. I've been watching who's going to be on the record. Who's going to talk about this? Are we going to get a message from the White House, the National Security Council, the Department of Defense? Could we hear from the Secretary of State? Who could we hear from? The Secretary of State was actually in Europe at a G7 conference. And so he had a press conference this morning that was already planned. He was talking about a lot of other things before the questions started. None of them involved the breaking news. So here's the first question that he received, and I want everyone to hear this for themselves.
Thank you very much. Mr. Secretary, there is a lot to ask you about today, so with your indulgence. First, on Israel's strikes in Iran, was the U.S. indeed alerted in advance? How far ahead of time? And did it raise any objections when it was? Are the strikes now over? And do you have any indication at this early stage via direct or indirect messaging that Iran will respond? And have there been any changes in Iran's nuclear program?
On the first question, the reports that you've seen, I'm not going to speak to that, except to say that the United States has not been involved in any offensive operations. What we're focused on, what the G7 is focused on, and again, it's reflected in our statement and in our conversation, is our work to de-escalate tensions, to de-escalate from any potential conflict. You saw Israel on the receiving end of an unprecedented attack, but our focus has been on, of course, making sure that Israel can effectively defend itself, but also de-escalating tensions, avoiding conflict, and that remains our focus.
I'm smiling because we could start a drinking game with coffee, because that's what you need, Benham, nothing else.
And that's what's in here. Don't worry.
We both have it for the number of times we can say de-escalation that we're going to hear it today. But in that short answer, we heard it quite a bit. So I think that's interesting. It's so consistent with what you're saying. What do you make of this statement coming from the Secretary of State? And what do you make of the lack of other statements thus far today about what has transpired? By the way, this has also been a pattern that we saw really over the weekend. We saw this huge attack happen on Israel, a historic attack. We saw some state posts, social media posts from the White House, but not a lot. It was very tempered. So what do you think of this, these comments? What do you think of the lack of leaning into the microphone at this very moment?
Well, the first thing I would say is the public domain, meaning the information domain, the media domain, things that are readily available to read and see and hear, can and has indeed been weaponized. So the volume of information, as well as the quality of information, are always things to look out for as soon as something happens, right? Who's responding ASAP, who's driving a narrative, who's undermining a narrative. This is just, you know, good to know in general. And in this instance, exactly what you mentioned is the thing that was striking, which is the absence of official commentary from Jerusalem, from Tehran, and certainly from Washington on what is going on here. Even the Israelis had tweeted, if I'm not mistaken, tagging the Supreme Leader of Iran in their tweet. I forgot if it was the defense minister or someone else from Prime Minister Netanyahu's war cabinet, saying if Israeli territory is struck, Iranian territory would be struck. And for Iran to go, remember, the public domain, so public with moving out of the shadows and striking Israel with those three very different kinds of weapons. And then for the Israelis to go back and do a similar kind of attack that you saw in February 2022 and January 2023, if indeed it is proven that these were lower and slower flying quadcopter drones that had to be operated from very nearby, so it might be a neighboring country or might be agents, assets, supporters, whatever, within Iran, which raises a lot more questions. The Israelis look like they were able to punch back but try to reset the rules of the game to pre-April 1st or pre-certainly April 13th. And the lack of commentary is designed to give the Iranians, I think, a face-saving line of retreat for them to fill the propaganda void, as they seem to have been doing already on Friday morning, and already Friday prayers have finished in Iran. They're, again, about 8.5 hours ahead, to not have to talk about this, to present the faux image of normalcy such that the shadow war can again be managed. This is, you know, long-term strategic thinking. This is more crisis management than crisis solving. This does not at all mean there is peace. This does not all mean that the government, which says death to Israel, does not mean it anymore. But it means that a major tit for tat that could easily go to an escalatory spiral with exceptionally fast and high-flying and destabilizing weapons from both sides, for the moment, for the tip of the weekend, seems to have been averted.
And can I just share this with you? Can I share this with you really quick? It's the Prime Minister of Israel. I'm just holding it up for those of us for those of you listening on podcasts. I know this is not going to be exact, but those watching, this is Prime Minister Netanyahu. There's something blurred out on the desk, so you have to look a little closer. And the translation is simply Shabbat Shalom, and that's it. I mean, the typical Friday greeting, right? It's which seems very intentional. That's not a broader statement about Israel's military posture, or maybe it is, Benham. He has several accounts, by the way, I've noticed. So you have to kind of sort through.
Figure out which is.
Yes. But anyways, I mean, what...
You know, you want to talk about reading something into it, right? Today is April 19th. What is April 19th? The Supreme Leader of Iran's birthday. He turned 85 today. So,
well, you know what? He's on Twitter too. So I'm going to look him up.
Everyone's on Twitter except me.
Are you serious? You just decided you can't do it? Is it just...
Just decided long ago I would, with immense respect to everybody who's on and whatever, I just thought it was a cesspool. And unfortunately, I get more data proven that it's right rather than I'm wrong.
Really? Well, I'm grateful for it because of this reason.
It is a critical news tool. I'm not denying
it. It is a critical news tool, and very interesting. And this will kind of wrap into what we're talking about. You know, having the Ayatollah on X is very helpful because you get a direct quote from him. Otherwise, it would be
I'd
very
love it if
difficult.
The Ayatollah was off X.
If I had the choice, because here's probably a year or so ago at the Smarter News, I just took some screenshots of the Ayatollah, what he was saying, and I shared them on Instagram. And Instagram actually shut down some of his accounts, if I'm not mistaken. So it depends on the social media platform. But when I shared his posts, the reaction I got from our audience was, "Oh, are this real? Is that a parody account?" Because it's shocking. And violent and very clear about a dislike of America. And we're not confronted with that regularly in the news. So I think in that way, it's very helpful. You speak and read Farsi. What have you been looking at Farsi news sources overnight? What is the tone and the tenor coming from that sort of... when you see the difference between, let's say, English reporting, Western media reporting, and what's being reported in Farsi?
There are, well, just in the lead up to this, actually, I was trying to finish this one last point. It came to my mind. After Iran launched that missile barrage, the head of the IRGC came out and he said, you know, we have a new doctrine now, because indeed this was overt and such a change and such a break with the past. And I talked about right now Israel trying to reset the rules of the game back to that which it was. The IRGC commander said that if we are attacked again, or our interests are attacked again, we essentially, I'm paraphrasing, reserve the right to respond from within Iran. So again, he doubled down on the scary thing, right? The threat of more overt and conventional war, other than a conflict which could have been, you know, contained. So that was his way of trying to deter a future Israeli response, or a more public, one could say, Israeli response, to keep it below a certain threshold, right? Now that the attack did appear to be under a certain threshold, the pressure for the regime to have to jump on it in their propaganda is lessened. And indeed, we mentioned there are lots of TV outlets in Iran right now showing pictures of squares in Isfahan, of normal city life. The attack hasn't really factored in, thus far as what we could read and see, into most of the Friday prayer sermons. There's three big themes still. There's still, you know, trying to pivot from the Israel-Iran war to keeping the focus on the Israel-Gaza war. The second is still continuing the chest beating after the April 13, April 14 strike. And something tied to that is just a few days ago, the head of the aerospace force, the command in charge of Iran's ballistic missiles, which for almost two decades now, the U.S. government has said is the largest ballistic missile arsenal in the Middle East. That guy, he was walking down the street, or he was kind of mobbed by press, if you will, as he was walking. And they said, if Israel responds militarily against Iran, would you again launch missiles? Would you again be overtly and kinetically involved? And without even a beat, almost in like a street thuggish style, like slang, he just dismissed the guys like 100% we'd fire. This is just out of the blue, like this kind of cavalier cowboy attitude, which so you're seeing more of that continue to echo, that their, you know, cavalier out of character overt attack spooked the Israelis such that there has been no Israeli response. So they're quote unquote pocketing the win, or they're doing the PR lap very much that the Biden administration wanted the Israelis to take the win, if you will. So it's a different win that the Iranians are trying to pocket. Whereas in reality, the facts on the ground belie that. that Israel could penetrate your airspace, that if indeed this was a drone, this was probably launched from nearby. So again, more of your country is penetrated. You know, I mentioned this because...
Do you think it was launched from inside Iran? Do you think that's the case? On,
I think that's the case. I certainly think
so
that,
you, okay, that's the so case just to
for
be
the
clear.
Older drone attacks.
Okay, that it could be some sort of operation by Israel inside Iran geographically.
Yes.
And that would be even more of, by the way, we're in your backyard.
Absolutely.
Just FYI.
Because there's been a string of assassinations and like sabotage attacks that physically had to be carried out from Iran. If you look at the trend lines from 2018 to 2020, but most importantly, 2020 to 2022. And all of those hallmarks required on the ground logistical things. So sometimes there was sabotage at a nuclear facility. Sometimes there was an explosion. Sometimes there was a drone strike with a drone that couldn't operate beyond a certain radius. So you would need an individual on the ground to actually be lo-fi or hi-fi with that drone radar. So these are things that show the Islamic Republic is punctured. And don't take it from me. Take it from a former Iranian intelligence minister who I think the one right before COVID, I'm blanking on his name. He said, you know, no Iranian government officials should sleep soundly at night. This is when some IRGC officials were being killed inside Iran. And in the run-up to Iran's missile strike against Israel on April 13th, April 14th, let me tell you this joke I heard from a friend actually from Iran, who said that the joke was as Iran was trying to figure out a target, you know, if they wanted to kill Israelis in response to the April 1st attack, that the IRGC Aerospace Force, instead of firing at Israel, should fire at the Supreme Leader's office because there's probably more Israeli spies in there. And this just goes to show you the nature of the thinking. And even let me go one further. Talk about social media. I just denigrated it. But tons of people have been sharing with me graffiti in Iran, across Iran, with different hashtags, with different slang things like Beit Robezan, like which means hit the house, which means go for the Supreme Leader. You've had Iranian activists on social media, some who are stateside, some who are not, some who were jailed, talk about hitting the grave site, the mausoleum, if you will, of the founding father of the Islamic Republic in an overt Israel. The people are giving coordinates and targeting ideas to the Israelis. It doesn't mean that people covet a war, but this just goes to show you that in the post-October 7 Middle East, while the images look like the Arab world and Israel cut, and particularly the Muslim world and Israel cut, and you see Palestinian flags as far away as Malaysia, and you see anti-Israel marches across many Western European democracies and capitals. In Iran, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, you couldn't have it the other way. You don't see Palestinian flags unless it's an official government function. Less than 48 hours after the October 7 terrorist attack, you had Iranians in a soccer stadium in the thousands when someone tried to raise a Palestinian flag onto the field, chanting, shove it up, you know where, again and again and again. You've had multiple slogans since 2009 by Iranian protesters chastising this regime for spending their national wealth and squandering their national resources on material support of terror against Israel. And if you just look on, again, this Twitter or X, there are tons of organic touch points and instances, including major Iranian soccer stars, people like Ali Karimi, who is, I believe, now outside the country, talking about the friendship between Iranians and Israelis. So what looks like the trend lines of trouble across the region, if you just go one level below, one level beneath the government, there is room for cautious optimism. Once the boom and the bangs and all the things that stop exploding, there is room for that cautious optimism. And I think this is a Shimon Peres quote because it's a matter of, you know, something happening, but you don't know when. And I think they asked him about something, the peace process. He's the former prime minister of Israel. I believe he passed away recently. And, you know, they said about the peace process, he said, the good news is there's light at the end of the tunnel. The bad news is there's no tunnel. So the good news is the Iranian population, which has contested its own their regime for 40 plus years, also happens to side with America and with Israel on the big picture national security issues in the way that most in the region do not. The problem is the U.S. and the others don't have a real pathway to empower the Iranian people. And in the absence of that, we continue to deal with this boom and bust cycle of terrorism, of drone strikes, of missile strikes, and of the media hullabaloo that we all live in, brought to you by the government of the Islamic Republic.
I had a very interesting question from one of our audience members this week about the difference between Iran and the Islamic Republic and you, the use of those terms. Because when I'm giving a headline or I'm talking to our audience at Smarter News, I'll say Iran and Israel, and I'm talking about these very fluid. But there's been this question that's come up. Well, is Iran the Islamic Republic? Or should we be making this differential between the government of Iran and the people? How would you advise if you were my editorial? Yeah, if you were my editorial advisor, how would you advise Smarter News to approach that? And what do you think our audience should know about the difference between the Iranian government and the people of Iran?
You couldn't have asked a better question, because there's a great temptation to conflate them. And I'm coming off of a few days ago on April 17th, a testimony before a joint committee at the House Foreign Affairs Committee. And in fact, a congressman asked me about, you know, a quote from Senator McCain, where he said, you know, Russia is a gas station. He said, do you believe Iran is a gas station? I said, Senator, I said, Congressman, as a proud Iranian American, and I'm paraphrasing, but the video is out there. You know, the government of Iran today does not hold a candle to the glorious civilization that that country had. This is the government of Iran today is a poor guardian of its own national interest. It fails at doing the basic job of a government, and it fails at holding a candle to that legacy of almost 3,000 years that it would have otherwise inherited. So it's a break rather than a continuity in that larger civilizational discourse. And that's something critical to know. And the way I tell people here in Washington, and have been for years now, I've been with FTD for over a decade, you know, ringing the alarm bell on this issue, is don't use the word Iranian regime. Regime is a bad word. It's a pejorative word. Iranian is supposed to be something good. It has the culture, it has the carpus, it has the history, right? So if Iranian is good and regime is bad, don't put those two things together. If it's the government of Iran, say Iranian government. But if you're using regime for that inherently pejorative connotation, call it something else, the clerical regime, the Islamist mm-hmm. regime, or you can call it by its name. I often call it the Islamic Republic, or I say Tehran, or Iran's leaders, or the clerical leadership, or whatever other phrase you want to use. But I've had a little mini crusade against the phrase Iranian regime for as long as I've been in Washington, and certainly as long as I've been in FDD, because there couldn't be a bigger gap. You see it again in the protests, in the Twitter slogans, in the fact that, you know, there have been protests against this government as long as almost this government has been in power. You've seen, you know, particularly the Iranians try, despite the Islamic Republic being an autocracy and an Islamist government and the population largely being secular and nationalist and trying to have representative government, they used to participate in these sham elections just to try to move the needle along, just for the democratic exercise. And they used to have higher turnout rates than some Western democracies. But really, since 2016-17, really 17, there has been a doing away with this entire edifice. People are done with reform. They are outright talking about revolution. And the problem is Washington for many years has kind of been done with the regime change business. It has that sticky definition of war and the Iraq war, whereas in reality, there are very few places in the world, maybe outside Israel, very few places in the Middle East, where what is morally good and what is strategically sound are on the same page. And supporting the people of Iran against the government of the Islamic Republic is one of those few examples. And it's a waning asset. So the wake-up call consistently has been to focus on the people. Step one, you know, first, do no harm. And then in a world, you know, if we're recommending for what Washington do next, in a world where you're constraining and limiting and containing and deterring and using all options, you know, military, economic, political, intelligence against the regime, like a maximum pressure 2.0, if you will, you got to have a maximum support 1.0 for the Iranian people. And this would be a very complementary prong. And this, I think, would really go to move the needle on both what's been happening internally and in the region.
That gives us a lot to think about. And I appreciate the insight there, because I don't think that insight is being shared as we're doing kind of quote unquote normal news coverage of what's happening in the Middle East. There's not a lot of attention right now about the desires of the Iranian people, though I want to hold on to the optimism of potential change. I also just want to end with a question that's perhaps a little bit darker, which is, what is the risk that you see here in this current, the last several weeks? What is this exposed? What are the stakes that we're facing?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I'm in the reality business. And reality, the trend lines of the facts on the ground for the government. The government is more cohesive than ever before. Even though all these hardliners have lots of fights with one another, they function akin to a mafia. They have different factions and views, but ultimately they're loyal to one big family. And ironically, you've had their supreme leader trim the size of that family in Iran, really since 2005. So the people at the helm today are either the octogenarians like himself who came through everything, or a second tier cadre who are zealous believers and perhaps not so competent managers. And these people are actually eerily comfortable with conflict. They don't want a war because, you know, obviously that regime, they don't spend, you know, anywhere compared to their neighbors on their military. They have high return on investment by forcing you to spend more on missile defense when they spend on missiles, forcing you to spend more on air defense when they spend on drones. But they're not a tier one Western military, but they are a potent national security threat for us and our partners and our allies in the region. And the problem is they're more comfortable with conflict. And in all the places where Washington and his partners have said there is no military solution, somehow these guys have found a military solution. In Syria with Assad, in Yemen with the Houthis, in Iraq with the militias, in Lebanon with Hezbollah, in Hamas, in Gaza with Hamas. In all of those jurisdictions are restraining and are freezing up impulse, largely but not exclusively brought to you by the hangover of the Iraq war and the politics therein. Those are things that the regime has capitalized on. And it is going to get worse before it gets better. We are not out of the Israel-Iran shadow war. We are not out of the potential for another territorial retaliation between Israel and Iran. What the Israelis try to do is reset deterrence and manage escalation. It's up to the Iranians to fully take the off-ramp all the way. Who knows if they choose to get off that ramp at a different stop? Certainly, ideologically, they're not inclined to. And we have to be sober about that. We have to be vigilant about that. But we also have to be willing to connect the dots that what we see in the Middle East is not going to be limited to the Middle East. I'll end with this. You know, three years ago, our friends across the Atlantic in Europe laughed at many in Washington, yours truly, but I wasn't in government, but yours truly, who was ringing the alarm bell at something that the administration, the Trump administration, was ringing, which was the widening radius of Iran's arms proliferation. People laughed at the idea of Iran exporting arms globally. Now Iran is supporting Russia's war in Ukraine and is critically doing it and is set to scale it up with potentially not just drone transfers, but missile transfers. These are game-changing developments by elites and leaders in the regime who are comfortable with conflict, who are increasingly taking risks and are increasingly joining an authoritarian axis and are able to compartmentalize their differences with countries they've had historic enmity with, like Russia, just so that they can contest America. And we got to take a page from their book and bridge the gap between us and our partners and allies, recognize this connective tissue where it exists, and push back holistically.
You know, I'm just thinking about the calendar. Each day as we get closer to the election, and we know that the priority of our administration is de-escalation. Obviously, there's debate about that. I just can't help but feel that pressure, because to some, that's going to look like an opportunity for more mischief. And I'm using that term very, you know, generally, because there's a desire not to. We're not as comfortable with conflict right now, overall, period, end stop, political party, we're not that. And so it makes me a little nervous just hearing that, admittedly, that calendar. So there's going to be a lot coming across, you know, my desk. There's going to be a lot of news alerts that our audience is going to see. It's just going to come up on their phones, whether they like it or not. Can you just give us one thing you're going to be watching for, Benham, over, you know, whether it's over the next week or what is, despite all the noise, what is the one thing that you're really focused on or trying to prioritize?
Well, it's continuing to see how Iran chooses to respond, whether there's more proxy attacks against Israel, whether they take the off-ramp the whole way. But I'm just literally the military commanders in Iran, seeing what General Salami says, commander of the IRGC, seeing what the Aerospace Force commander says, Hajizadeh is his name, and seeing if the proxies and militias feel emboldened to step up their attacks again. I think that in the next few weeks, the political direction from Tehran and the military direction from the region could be set to change. For the better or the worse, we don't know.
Well, we'll let you try to get a little bit of rest before the next bit. I doubt that's going to happen, but I'm really sorry. But maybe just in your office for the next 2 hours, you could just sort of lean back and shut your eyes.
I'm rolling into another podcast right after this.
Are you okay? I got to let you go. Yes. I got to let you go. It's great to have you as always. Thank you so much for the time.
And thank you so much.
We always look forward to having you back. Thank you.
Thank you. A pleasure.